Hello, Illinois Radio Reader listeners. This is Elizabeth McMahon with the News Gazette for Wednesday, April 23rd, 2025. I'm going to start this morning on the front page and we'll work through local and state news. And then in the second half, I will cover obituaries and sports, among other stories. So on the front page this morning, we have a big photo taking up the above and below the fold with the headline, "It's Showtime," with all eyes on Champaign-Urbana. And this is a big photo of a man making, doing some tweaks, making some cleaning up the statue of Roger Ebert. And the caption reads, on Ebert Fest Eve, Champaign Park District carpenter Bob Ginger waxed the statue of the festival's namesake outside the Virginia Theater. While inside, the 70-millimeter print of The Watchers was being prepped for screening. The 1956 John Wayne starring film, which Roger Ebert gave a 4-star review, will become the first Western to be shown at the festival when the lights go dark at 6:30 tonight. Beforehand, guests will gather at U of I President Tim Killeen's house for the opening night gala. And that photo there is by Robin Schultz. And across the top of the front page of the News Gazette, the story right above the fold there is focused on the new library director in Champaign-Urbana at the Urbana Free Library, with the headline, "CU Native Headed Home as New Library Director." And this story is by Yana Wiersema. Talia Abdullah believes reading has a way of building communities. The executive director of the public library in Flint, Michigan, saw this firsthand during her time as a school librarian at Urbana's Martin Luther King Jr. Elementary. "We had children who came and did not speak any English," she said, "and the power of storytelling and reading and looking at books together just really had a significant impact in building connections and building bridges between no English and limited English learners and people who have lived in the United States all their life." Abdullah plans to bring that same focus on community to her upcoming role as the Urbana Free Library's next executive director. At a brief special meeting Tuesday night, the Library Board of Trustees approved Abdullah's appointment. Board President Daniel Urban said Abdullah's starting date will be July 7th so that she can fulfill her current commitments at the Gloria Coles Flint Public Library. Rachel Fuller has been serving as interim executive director since the departure of Celeste Motos in September. Motos, who was the library's executive director for a little over 10 years, moved to Michigan to live with her husband. Urban said that the feedback from staff and community members who have met Abdullah has been resoundingly positive, and he expects her to be a very good fit with the library. "She just has a wealth of experience in a number of positions across the country," he said. "She's been in Denver and San Francisco and Michigan. Talia is actually originally from here, grew up here, so this will be a homecoming for her." "I'm really excited to be back home," Abdullah said. Born and raised in Champaign, she was a student at the Unit 4 school system, studied at Parkland College in eastern Illinois, and completed her graduate studies at the University of Illinois. Abdullah has been working in libraries for about 30 years, getting her start at U of I's Graduate Library and the Granger Engineering Library Information Center. After that, she became a school librarian at King Elementary. She left Champaign-Urbana in late 2004 and went on to work at public libraries in Colorado, California, and Michigan. "She looks forward to giving back to the library that has given so much to me throughout my entire life. I want to honor who and what Urbana Free Library is and what it brings to the community, and also hear from community members what is it that they need that the library may not yet be providing," Abdullah said. And moving on the front page, we have a story here focused on the Christie Clinic Illinois Race Weekend, and with the headline, "He's Racing to Honor His Brother," and this is a story by Dave Hinton of the News Gazette. While laid back about most things, the late Corey Thompson was quite adamant about letting those he loved know how special they were to him. That That's according to his brother Ryan, who plans to do the same in memory of Corey in the Christie Clinic Illinois Half Marathon on April 26th. Corey will be uppermost on his mind through most of the 13.1-mile event. He was not extremely easy to get riled up, Ryan Thompson said, and at the same time, he was very particular about the things he was passionate about. He was very, very focused on his family. He made everyone feel very important, especially his family. He was over the top sometimes of wanting everything to feel meaningful, whether it was birthday parties or Easter egg hunts. At 32, Ryan is the oldest of three brothers, 4 years older than Corey, with Mitchell being the youngest. The St. Joseph Ogden grads shared a common love of cross-country and track, and Ryan's participation in the half marathon, he said, is one way to help with the grieving process. That's a race series both of us have run many times, Ryan said. Corey Thompson was a 28-year-old Illinois State police trooper when he died on October 28, 2024, from injuries received when a motorcycle he was riding on Leverett Road north of Champaign was struck by a truck driven by a Thomasboro resident. The wreck happened just 4 months after he married Chelsea Blaze on June 2nd. The couple had moved into the house where the three brothers grew up, west of St. Joseph, and where their parents had lived until not long before. Ryan Thompson said his brother's commitment was evident in ways such as the couple's wedding venue near Sevierville, Tennessee, at a place called the Trillium Venue. "When I saw that, I said, 'This is incredible,'" Ryan said. "I knew he had just poured hours and hours into researching the perfect place and time because he wanted it to be extremely meaningful." The couple knew Tennessee because that's the state where Blaze was a track standout at the University of Tennessee after starring at St. Joseph Ogden High School. Ryan Thompson said he's sure running the half marathon in his late brother's honor will be emotional, especially at the finish. "There have been times since his brother's passing while Thompson has been competing in a race that he can almost hear him urging him on, seeing his face in the crowd." Thompson said his brother's memory will be a motivator to keep on going through the pain that only a long-distance runner can know. He'll also hearken back to 2018 when Corey was running the Christie Marathon and Ryan joined his brother about 17 miles from the finish line and encouraged him the rest of the way through. "I ran with him until almost to the stadium for the finish," Ryan Thompson said. "The emotion will hit me afterwards. When it comes to trying to understand what he went through in the last moments of his life, I want to do the best I can to understand. He had so much of his life left to live." And finally, on the bottom of the front page of the News Gazette, we have a column by Bob Asmussen with the headline, "Urbana High Students Show Mettle at Science Olympiad." In the fall of 2022, two Urbana High School freshmen approached biology teacher Jeff Birdsley with an idea. They wanted to enter the Science Olympiad, and they wanted Birdsley as their coach. Birdsley's initial response, "What's that? Because it wasn't a thing when I was a student." They explained it, and Birdsley said no. He had plenty on his plate already with teaching and coaching Urbana's swim teams. "I just didn't have time." But within a few weeks, Birdsley stepped down from the boys' swim program, freeing up time for Science Olympiad. Good thing. After failing to qualify for the state finals the first year in 2023, Urbana finished 13th in 2024. That set up one of the best finishes ever by an Urbana high school team in any activity, a second place finish on April 12th. Lyle High School won the competition. "We had a goal this year to place top five at state. Thought it was realistic," Birdsley said. "The second place finish was unexpected, kind of a roller coaster. When it happened, it was bedlam. They were so happy. The camaraderie was so fantastic." Urbana had six gold medalists in their event, and I'm going to name them here. Colin Guth and Elliot Anderson, Wind Power. Elliot Anderson and Natalie Posiesk, which is a helicopter. Natalie Posiesk and J.J. Lee, Materials Science. J.J. Lee and Colin Guth, Robot Tour. Cecilia Birdsley and Sydney Godell, entomology. And Urbana's additional state medalists included Neha Bhargava and Mia Schroeder, optics. Mia Schroeder and Natalie Posiesk is forensics, and Cecilia Birdsley and Sydney Godell, which is the bungee, and that's their bungee drop. The late afternoon award ceremony was held at historic Huff Hall. "It's just great for the culture at Urbana High School," Birdsley said. "Many thanks to my athletic director, Steve Waller, and principal, Jesse Guzman, for supporting us through this. They obviously know the value of having extracurriculars." The second place trophy will be going into the case at Urbana High School. And the final step to number one seems like a good bet in 2026. Most of the team returns, including the core group of 11 freshmen who got the ball rolling back in 22. "I tell the kids you absolutely have a chance to win a state championship next year," Birdsley said. Urbana competes in Division 1A. Schools are seeded. Among the schools in Urbana's division were Palatine, Barrington, Urbana University High, Champaign Central, and Centennial. Uni High finished fourth, and Champaign's St. Thomas More finished in eighth place. "That marks the first time Urbana has ever come out ahead of Uni in the Science Olympiad," Birdsley said. The kids were just as proud of that as the second-place finish. The Science Olympiad is an annual state competition held on the University of Illinois campus. Teams of 15 students compete in 23 events. Every branch of science and engineering is represented, creating towers, bridges, helicopters, planes, and ping pong cannons on the building side. Most of the events are test-taking in various science disciplines. Fans and coaches were allowed to watch the building events, but the tests are students only. To reach state, schools advance from a local competition. Urbana was at Parkland College this year, where it finished second and earned a spot in the state finals. Uni High won the local competition. "It's a lot of work for the students, nights and weekends. Many, many, many hours of studying and preparing," Birdsley said. "They go home and make themselves experts on insects or build the best ping pong air cannon that they could possibly build." The Urbana team had meetings before and after school talking about goals. Looking ahead, the team will reconvene in September. A list of events for the 2026 Olympiad will be announced, and the Tigers will start preparation. "I try to get kids into something they're going to get passionate about," Birdsley said. Urbana had a Science Olympiad program in the 1990s and early 2000s. There are several regional trophies at the high school, but no state trophies until now. The school celebrated the accomplishments with daily announcements the following week. Birdsley carried the trophy around the school. Birdsley has been a teacher at Urbana High School since 2020. He and his wife, Becky Fuller, who is on the U of I faculty, have lived in Urbana for 20 years. Their son, Sam, is an Urbana High School graduate. Their daughter, Cecilia, has been a member of the Science Olympiad from the start and is also an Urbana swimmer. This year, fellow Urbana High School biology teacher Alex Riley, a U of I graduate, joined the team as a co-coach. His first year at the school was in 2023. "This was Alex's year to learn how Science Olympiad works and how to coach it," Birdsley said. "I'm still learning how to coach it." Birdsley and Riley welcome any student interested in participating. I'm going to move on to the Our Communities section on page A5 of the News Gazette, and where they have the Farm Family of the Week. And this column is by Dave Hinton. And the Farm Family of the Week, the headline reads, "Meet the Cressips of the Whiteheath Seymour Area." One ancestor was a famous frontiersman who was featured in a prominent magazine. Another was credited with assisting George Washington during the Revolutionary War. The Cressup family has a lineage that dates back to the 1700s in Maryland and Pennsylvania. Their descendants are this week's Farm Family of the Week. There are stories in National Geographic of Thomas Cressup being one of the most famous frontiersmen and aiding Washington while he was surveying the frontier. His son, Michael Cressup, is credited with helping to save Washington's army at the start of the Revolutionary War in 1775. Then later in Ohio, Michael was involved in numerous flights with the natives as settlers moved. With the natives as settlers moved west. maybe desiring a quieter life, they continued westward, eventually settling in Illinois and becoming farmers. And so now begins the Q&A with the Cressett family. How long has your family been farming? The Cressett's farm was founded in 1863 by Civil War Captain Benjamin Cressett and has been passed down throughout the generations. Today, Cressett Farms is operated by myself, William Cressett, fifth generation, my wife Liz, and our children. Benjamin and Sarah, our children Benjamin and Sarah, along with nephew Ryan Mitzdarfer, who's sixth generation. My father, Bruce, passed away in 2011 after spending a lifetime farming and instilling his passion for this land in William and his grandchildren. Where is your farm operation? The home farm is in the White Heath Seymour area, and we farm in Champaign and Piatt counties. What does your family operation consist of? Our farm is diversified. We operate a 700-head cattle feeding operation and grow both conventional and organic corn and soybeans. How many members of the family does the operation support? The farm supports my wife, Liz, and I, our children, and my mother, Judy, who has since retired but worked 35 years alongside my dad operating the farm. How have you seen farming change over the years? Technology and size of equipment has been the biggest thing I have seen change over the years. I'm fortunate that Ryan is a Case New Holland diesel power instructor at Parkland College. And looks like, okay, and this morning, it looks like at 8:20, Mike in the morning will visit with Will Cressup and takes the, well, sorry, and I that interrupted my flow here, which continues with that he was an instructor at Parkland College and takes the lead in implementing and managing all the technology, repairs, and maintenance for our equipment. Without his expertise and ability to stay up to date, it would make what we do a lot more difficult. With as beneficial as all this new technology is on the conventional side, we still go to school on the organic acres and see some pretty amazing yields. And then the next question is, your farm equipment, John Deere, green, red, Case IH, or other? Red is all you will ever see here. With the variety of activities and diversification of our operation, we use both older and newer Case IH equipment. I prefer operating the older equipment and favor the Farmall 806. Sarah, who is 16, prefers the Case 305. I like to say we have something for everyone around here. What makes farming such a good vocation? There are many things that make farming a good vocation, but family is number one. Sure, the hours are long and the days run together, especially with a larger livestock operation, but getting to spend your days doing what you love right alongside your wife, children, and nephew, knowing they enjoy it just as much as you do, there isn't anything better. If you could change one thing about farming, what would it be? It would be that the young, small farmer had more opportunities to get started. I read a statistic the other day from the USDA 2022 census that from 2017 to 2022, the U.S. lost approximately 141,000 farms. The only size category of farms that did not decrease was farms over 5,000 acres. That's a trend that I wish was reversed. I wish more landowners could see the value in investing in the young producer who's trying to get started. What's the best time of year to be on the farm? There's no better season than harvest. It's when you finally get to reap the fruits of your labor. On the cattle side, my wife would say, any day that is marketing day. What other areas of interest is your farm, is your family involved in? Vacations are hard to come by around here, but a hobby the entire family enjoys is tractor pulling. Ben, Sarah, and I have an IH-856, and my nephews, Ryan and Riley, have an IH-806 that we pull in the Ileana Pullers naturally aspirated class. In the wintertime, you can usually find us in the bleachers at basketball games. And there are two photos here, one of Ben Cressup pulling his IH-856, and then there's a photo of the family with Ben Cressup, Sarah, Liz, Will, Rowan Mitzdarfer, Ryan Mitzdarfer, and Katie Mitzdarfer, all standing in front of an antique tractor. Moving on in the Our Communities section, we have a column by Jim Dye with the headline, our leading lights taking the low road politically. In 1992, Iowa U.S. Senator Tom Harkin went searching for a gimmick to draw attention to his campaign for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination. The populist firebrand eventually settled on the use of profanity as a means of appearing authentic. Harkin failed as a candidate, eventually endorsing rival Bill Clinton, but he succeeded in drawing attention, both positive and negative, to his embrace of the then unembraceable public use of profanity. Harper's Magazine thought Harkin's vocabulary so unique that it counted the frequency of Harkin's use of the B word, an adjective intended to portray his opponent's positions as misleading or deceptive. Number of times Senator Tom Harkin used the word beep, expletive, in public speeches last summer? 17, it reported. In his own way, Harkin has proved to be a rhetorical trailblazer. These days, politicians in both parties routinely and publicly use what is considered foul language. In addition to calling his opponents losers and scumbags, President Donald Trump has employed vulgar adjectives to make his points. Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin once professed to be scandalized because Trump, in his first term private meeting, used a profane adjective to describe the country of Haiti. These days, Durbin's fellow Democrats fire one expletive after another at the political opposition. Illinois' junior U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth has dropped a series of F-bombs to denounce Trump, chastise former cable program host Tucker Carlson, and challenge the credibility of U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. In a recent interview, she added to her repertoire by accusing Trump of defecating, not her specific word, on the American flag. The insulting language has gone beyond profanity to meanness. U.S. Texas Representative Jasmine Crockett recently lampooned Texas Governor Greg Abbott as Governor Hot Wheels, an obviously demeaning reference to a disability that requires him to use a wheelchair. Forbes magazine in 2012 asked, "When can a politician use profanity, if ever?" 7 years later, Politico answered that question with a story headlined, "F-bombs away, why lawmakers are cursing now more than ever." It's nothing new for those who hold positions high or low to express themselves in vulgar terms. For some, it's part of their private vocabularies, and politicians are no exception, even when they pretend otherwise. When he was vice president, Richard Nixon praised President Dwight Eisenhower for restoring clean language to the White House, a clear reference to President Truman's expletive-laden vocabulary. Decades later, the White House tapes revealed that a private Nixon who was so profane that the Reverend Billy Graham, a longtime friend, said the tapes revealed a side of Nixon he did not know. CNN has identified other famously foul-mouthed in-private politicians, including Trump, Bill and Hillary Clinton, Dick Cheney, George W. Bush, and John Kerry. But what's with the public displays, and how does it go over with their audiences? It's a sign of the times. National writer Noah Rothman said, "These crass displays could be interpreted as earthy expressions of candor that are applauded by those who agree with the speaker." But he said, "They are more likely a tactic that can be characterized as an anti-intellectual shtick aimed at manipulating the audience into exhibiting an emotional response to otherwise deficient stimuli." In other words, those who cannot make a cogent argument engage in name-calling to state their cases. Loudness does not equate with logic, but the name of the political game is tapping into audience emotions, resentments, and grievances by any means necessary. Some, of course, object on grounds of taste alone, but it's a new world, for good or ill, and that ship sailed long ago. Moving on in local news, on page A8, we have a story by Luke Taylor with the headline, "Champagne Man Pleads Guilty to Escape. Original charges of breaking into Urbana apartment dropped." A Champaign man pleaded guilty to escape, a Class 3 felony, and saw charges dropped against him for his alleged involvement in breaking into an apartment near Urbana Middle School in 2023. Devarian D. Epps, 23, was awaiting trial on charges of home invasion, armed robbery, and aggravated discharge of a firearm after he was accused of being one of three individuals to break into a home on the 1200 block of South Vine Street on November 19, 2024. He was released on October 31, 2024, with orders to return to jail on November 2. During his release, he was being monitored with an electronic tracking bracelet. At 8:31 a.m. on November 2, just under 30 minutes before he was meant to report to jail, the bracelet set off an alert that the strap was being tampered with at Home Depot in Champaign. Law enforcement officers located the broken bracelet, and Home Depot surveillance footage showed Epps removing it. He was eventually located and arrested by the Urbana Police Department on December 23rd. The original charges, now dismissed, allege that Epps, another man, and a juvenile went to the house of an individual who had arranged to sell cannabis to the juvenile on November 19th. Both of the adults were allegedly armed. The resident, who was bleeding from his left eye, told police that Epps pistol whipped him in the face and the three individuals stole cash and cannabis. The group left and the resident chased them with his own firearm and they exchanged gunfire, according to state's attorney Julia Reitz. Epps was later found by police in the Urbana High School parking lot with a gunshot wound in his lower back. He was wearing clothes that matched those seen in surveillance footage tied to the robbery, and the resident later identified him and the two others in a photo lineup. The charges related to that incident have been dismissed, as has a charge for failure to report to the jail. Epps has been sentenced to 7 years in prison to be followed by 6 months of mandatory supervised release. He has credit for 121 days of time served. In other news, here we have a Virginia theater-focused story with the headline, Elvis Costello Booked for October Show. This is by Jeff D'Alessio. 4 decades after his first local show, Elvis Costello is coming back with a set list of hits from that era. The Rock and Roll Hall of Famer has been booked for an October 14th show at Champaign's Virginia Theater. It was announced Tuesday. Tickets, priced at $65, $79, $99, and $135, plus a processing fee of $7 to $13, go on sale at 10 a.m. Friday. The 70-year-old Costello, who played Huff Jim as a solo artist in the spring of 1984, will be joined this time by his band, The Imposters, along with former Bob Dylan guitarist Charlie Sexton. The Champaign date is one of 22 being added in September and October to Costello's Radio Soul, the early songs of Elvis Costello tour. As the playful billing suggests, the show will feature numbers drawn from record releases from My Aim Is True in 1977 to Blood and Chocolate in 1986, along with other surprises, according to Tuesday's announcement. Costello said, for any songwriter, it has been a compliment if people want to hear songs written up to 50 years ago. And finally, we have a story focused on State Senator Emile Jones' III bribery trial with the headline, Jury Sends Out a Series of Questions During First Day of Deliberations. And this is by Caroline Kubzanski and Sam Charles. Jurors in the federal corruption trial against Illinois State Senator Emile Jones III sent the judge a series of questions Tuesday before wrapping a first full day of deliberations. The panel sent U.S. District Judge Andrea Wood 5 questions that centered around the intent and timing of the alleged $5,000 campaign contribution at the heart of the prosecution's case. The judge, prosecutors, and Jones's defense lawyers spent hours hashing out language to send back. Among the questions was whether Jones needed to agree to accept something worth $5,000 or anything of value, and whether a decision to do so needed to remain in place without Jones changing his mind. The panel also asked about the difference between federal and state laws against bribery. Soon before jurors were set to leave for the day, Wood relayed to them that the crime of bribery, as charged in count one, has been committed at the time the defendant solicits, agrees to accepts or accepts a thing of value, so long as all the elements of the crime are satisfied at that point in time. Deliberations are expected to continue today. The deliberations have now stretched to about 10 hours after 9 days in which prosecutors argued that Jones sold his power as a state senator for the promise of the $5,000 campaign contribution and a minimum wage job for a former intern. And I'm going to take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the News Gazette for April 23rd, 2025, shortly. Please stay tuned.